once again we caution you. These stories are definitely not for the timid soul. So we tell you calmly and very sincerely, if you frighten easily, turn off your radio now.
Can you feature that awful creature? Can you feature that ugly creature? Creature features and feature features about creatures. Creature features.
Material Podcast. I'm Tom Carnell.
I'm Heather Buckley.
And I'm Langley West.
And we have the return of Steve Johnson, effects
legend. It's like the return of the living dead when you put it that way. Part three.
Right. Well, due to a computer glitch, we lost a good portion of a very excellent conversation that we had.
I was a goddamn genius in that.
You are a goddamn genius, sir. But we're having you on because you are not only a household name, but also you have a Kickstarter coming up for a book project.
It's actually we're kind of in the final days. Is that right?
Well, we've got 10 days left, which is really means we've only been going. It's a 30-day campaign, so we've got 1/3 left of our time, and we're over 80% funded. It's going gangbusters.
Yes, sweet. Do you think you're gonna?
I've already donated because I need.
Oh, no. Did you ask me if I think we're going to fund? Not only are we going to fund, we're going to overfund. It's a matter of how much now.
Yes.
I mean, the thing that's interesting about this Kickstarter, it's not like a lot of Kickstarters. Like if you see people that are doing a movie, for instance, they ask for $80,000. You can throw in a $10,000 donation to become an executive producer or, you know, there's all these things. But with our Kickstarter, we're basically just pre-selling the book. So when we overfund, it's not a matter of, you know, what are we going to do with all that money? People are just getting books for it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've had a couple of successful Kickstarters, and
approach to what we're doing,
and the rewards are where all the I think where all the work is. You know, not only are you
but the thing is, again, on ours we don't have that kind of stuff. I mean, we are there's one level where there's going to be a limited edition of Slimer, and if we were going visual, I could show you. I started sculpting it yesterday, and then there's a T-shirt, and then there's a dinner, but the rest of it is just buy a hardcover or a softcover. I mean, I think it's a very honest way to approach something like this. It's basically like pre-selling the book.
Right. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we have you for a limited time today is because you need to get done with this reward.
Well, Slimer needs me. He's had a very tough year.
Sure. Well, yeah.
Yeah. That's a whole other thing. So that's great. That's always good news. That's a great place to be in, knowing that you're funding, knowing your money's coming in, and now all you got to do is just hit your marks.
Having said that, people, don't sit on your ass and fucking send in money, because this book is collection of books is going to be amazing.
It is, and the thing about it is, I mean, if people don't actually pledge for the book on Kickstarter, pre-order it through Kickstarter, it will be much more difficult to get it after the fact.
Right.
So there is kind of a limited, you know, Ron Popeil infomercial thing going on here.
Well, you know, I just got something similar on a Hunter S. Thompson photo book that this guy did.
Yeah.
And he was only doing it via, like, the only ones that were going to be made were via his Kickstarter.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, what do you do? I mean, that's what the Kickstarter is for. You're raising the money to do this job.
It's like what we did.
If you don't have the money, you don't do the job.
It's like what we did for Carbon Octum 20, where we got our money, we printed our books, and that was it.
Right.
It's not really the case here. I mean, this is not, if you don't, you know, pledge on Kickstarter, there are going to be other avenues to get this. It's just, this is the easy and the most easiest and the most direct way to get it.
Right.
It's, why is this story very important? I was going to say, why is this a story very important to tell? Because it's not just your story. It's also your story and place and what the industry was like during the time when you were becoming the Steve Johnson we all know today.
It, but it's really important to tell because, you know, it, the book is very unique in that no one has ever done something like this and no one ever will again, I don't think, because most people in the industry actually care about their careers and I don't. So I've been very honest in it and, you know, almost to a fault. And I don't hurt anyone other than myself. I do crucify myself. I nail my wrists to the cross. But, you know, it's funny and it's engaging and it's a window for future generations. It's a window for them to look through and see what the glory days of makeup effects and creature creation was like in the 80s and 90s. And it was a pretty magical time. I mean, we were like rock stars back then. We had groupies. We rubbed shoulders with the directors in the trenches. And it was an amazing, amazing time. And this book really shines a spotlight on that. And it's very, very unique in that respect.
Was it? A mind fuck to come from Texas out there and then realize that, you know, not only are you getting to do what you've been wanting to do so badly, but that you're realizing there's this kind of whole culture built up around because all of a sudden the effects guy is the rock star.
It was a total mind fuck because when I was in high school and junior high, I mean, I never dated girls. I was terrified of girls. I was bad at math. I was always chosen last for the softball team. And my mother was so supportive and she said, listen, when you move out to California, you're going to be around like minds, and you will blossom. Because, you know, I grew up in Texas, and, you know, if I even mentioned the word makeup, the cowboys would beat the shit out of me. You
know? Yeah, wow.
So it was really weird to suddenly be getting all this attention and to, you know, be respected for what I was doing rather than beaten up.
Right. It's really the only place to go then. You know, it's like there's no place else for me because I make monsters in my garage and so in addition to the amount of natural skill and the amount of work that you put in, there was a lot of luck involved too, just being in the right place at the right time.
Well, I don't really believe in luck. I think luck is a loser's way of you know, looking at the hard work and dedication from others. I don't think there's any such thing as luck. I think you create your own destiny and you do it through dedication and love for what you're doing. And if you are dedicated and if you love what you're doing, guess what? The doors to the universe will open and other people outside that don't necessarily have that dedication and love with it, but they'll call it luck. But it's not luck. It's not luck. There's no such thing.
Awesome. Did you... I can't remember if we talked about this last time or not, but I'll only stay on it for a second. Did you see the new Ghostbusters?
I haven't seen the new Ghostbusters. I haven't.
I was seeing. I can't remember where now. I saw the Slimer that Rick Lazzarini had been working on,
right?
Put together, from what I understand, it's just basically replaced with. Either replaced or covered with CG, which is really sad.
Like for the thingy, they did that with the thingy.
Right. The
well, it is yes. Sad, but I would like to say this. I mean, I don't think they gave Rick enough time or enough money to do what he needed to do, and so therefore they did. You know, this is the way that the business works. And I talked to Guillermo del Toro about this a long time ago when I was working on Blade 2, and he's like, you know, the reason people will replace a practical creation with digital or augment a practical creation with digital is that no one trusts it. So what happens is they give you less time to build it, less time to money, less money to build it, and they basically set you up to fail because all the producers at this point are just assuming they're going to have to put aside a whole lot of money for post-production to fix what you fucked up. And I'm not saying Rick fucked that up, but I'm just saying this is the mindset of producers now. They, you know, if they throw $50,000 at a practical creation, they're going to have $100,000 as a contingency to replace it or to augment it. And they just bank on it, and that's the way the business rolls these days. And it's sad because, you know, I really went after that job. I wanted to do Slimer justice again, and I came up with some amazing ideas. And they virtually wouldn't even take my calls, which is just really bizarre. But when I saw that they pushed Ivan Reitman, the original director and producer of Ghostbusters off of the new one.
Right.
Based on the fact that he was too old, and they said, look, he's too old. He doesn't know what the kids want. Fuck him, get him out of here. Let's just give him an executive producer credit. I felt a little bit better because I guess I'm too old to know what the kids want too. But hey, Rick's my age, so I don't know how that worked out.
Man, that.
Well, Tom Woodruff posted, and I actually read some of his about why did Jurassic Park practical and VFX, why it worked so well. And they said there was so much studying on how monsters move. There was practical stuff. I think they said there was about like only 63 plates of visual effects in the film, and just why it all worked together seamlessly, while contemporary movies with all this CGI are just, they're not lasting the test of time. And I haven't seen Ghostbusters to speak to Ghostbusters, but it was a very fascinating video to watch, because I saw it when it came out again on 3D, and I go, why does this movie still look amazing?
Well, you know, I don't, this is a complicated conversation. I don't know if we talked about it in the Lost podcast, but you know, my feeling is I'm kind of fed up with this witch hunt. Every time somebody mentions CGI, it's like a witch hunt. It's like, you know, from our camp, from the practical effects camp, they're like, fuck them. It should either be totally practical or it should be a blend. But, you know, the fact is, let's talk about The Thing, the remake of The Thing. Maybe I'm the only practical effects guy that enjoyed it. I liked it. I thought that there was a lot of really cool stuff in there that was digital and, you know, that couldn't possibly have been done practically. And people forget. They forget one really, really, really fundamental thing, and it's this. Guess what? Animatronics suck too. Digital sucks. Animatronics suck. It all sucks. I mean, animatronics can't emote as well as digital characters. They can't jump as high. They can't smile as genuinely. It takes a long time to shoot them. It takes puppeteers. It takes a lot of time in prep. You've got to make your decisions in prep, and then you've got a lot more time in post-production to fix it and change it if you're doing it digitally. I don't believe that this witch hunt is valid. I don't. Because I think what people are missing here, you know, guess what? Birthing pains hurt. You know, when you have a baby, it's very painful. And the digital takeover of the entertainment industry is very painful right now for people like me and ADI and all of us. But it doesn't mean that it's wrong. I truly believe that digital technology is the vein through which the lifeblood of our new entertainment will flow, and ultimately everybody will forget about, you know, practical effects just like we forgot about silent movies, you know?
Well, I think it's important, and it probably always will be, to take a look at the project and say, this is what I want for this project. Maybe I want a rubber monster for this. Or, you know, like picking the technology according to the project. You know, some things I think are meant to be stop motion. Some things...
Well, they wanted Hellboy originally to be a CGI creature until Del Toro pushed that it would be Ron Perlman in the suit.
Right. Again, finding that happy, that marriage, that balance, you know.
Well, I think it's the idea about tools, but also giving everyone time who has the tools to research and to advance things forward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, ideally, it would be for the whatever's best for the script, you know, but for the film.
Well, right. it also becomes a stylistic choice, you know.
Right. Something on Netflix right now, The Little Prince,
is
kind of interesting because... when you're in this one environment, it's all stop motion kind of paper stuff. It looks great. And when you're in the quote real world environment, it's a CG 3D kind of Pixar thing. And it's cool because it creates a visual separation between the two worlds, which is a cool artistic mm-hmm. choice.
Right. Again, yeah, it's a stylistic choice, and there's room for this kind of stuff. And Del Toro does it well. Tim Burton's done it well, but you know, it just I think people are forgetting the fact that the technology evolves in a way that it just in leaps and bounds. And so right now we're standing in 2016, and we're going, we've got one leg on the dock of practical effects from 20 years ago, and we've got another leg on the boat of the future of entertainment. And our legs are spreading and spreading and spreading, and it's painful because it's tearing us in half. But ultimately, people are not the uncanny valley they always talk about, how digital characters don't quite look real because the reptilian part of our brain kind of gets it in a way that we can't pinpoint, but we do get it. It's not real. Guess what? Give it 10 years. Give it 10 years.
Right.
I'm talking about like I'm a fucking digital technician over here.
Well, I'm curious about all these beautiful pictures you are posting from Boss Films. So I saw the beautiful Screaming Mad George, the understructure of the flying eye.
Right.
That you posted. And what other gems have you found in that collection? And are they going to be in the book?
They are, but one thing I have to say here that, you know, I want people to understand, I don't want anybody to, you know, to order Rubberhead Volume 1 and go, why isn't Big Trouble in China, Big Trouble in Little China in there? It's five volumes. So hopefully people, you know, will understand that this is a long story spread out over five volumes. And, yeah, they're all going to be in there. I mean, our failed Lost Boys is in there. That's going to be really good. You know, what Richard has given us is really cool because Richard Edlund is an amazing visual effects guy, Oscar winner. He used to... You know, he came up with a way to make spaceships move with motion control on Star Wars. I mean, he's an absolute genius. And I worked with him at Boss Film on all the greatest hits of the 80s, from Ghostbusters to Fright Night to Big Trouble in Little China to Poltergeist 2 to our failed Predator to our failed Lost Boys. And I didn't document the stuff back then because I was a cog in the wheel. But Richard did. I documented all the other stuff post-Boss Films. But Richard did, and he's given me the keys to the kingdom. So now there's a... You know, the hole that was there for those great films is now filled with all these amazing photographs. So it's going to be, people are going to lose their mind. I haven't even seen these photos. I mean, there's no reason for me to see them, but I'm seeing them now. And now all the fans will be able to see them as well. This is really going to, I think it's a little bit, at the risk of sounding like the pompous ass I am, it's going to kind of make history.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the horror fans nowadays don't really talk. Like, I love to talk about Boss Films, but a lot of the folks don't realize that a lot of those long, big-mouth monsters came from a group of superstars that came together to do practical effects during that time period. I think people don't talk about Boss Films enough.
And we were superstars. I mean, the fact that, you know, I had
You guys were like the super group. Mm-hmm.
I had Rick Lazzarini working for me. I had Steve Wang. I mean, all these people that went on to open their own companies were actually working at Boss Films under the umbrella of the Creature Shop there, and it was a who's who of effects people that went on to open their own companies. And how could you not create magic with that group of talented people?
Right, wow.
And on top of that, we had Richard Edlund, Optical Sorcery. What Richard wanted to do is he wanted to open one facility all under one umbrella where he could do have a shooting stage to shoot his effects and control them, do pyrotechnics, do optical and visual effects, do creature effects, do miniatures and models. And it was amazing because I think that was the first time that one company, you know, all the departments that would create magic could work together right in one company. And so we were all, you know, handshake agreements that if I do this, you can do it this way. And, you know, at that point, I'd only work with Canham and Botine and Baker, and we didn't have that. We were out on a desert island going, okay, we're the effects people. This is what we're going to do. But when I worked at Boss Film, it was like this huge consortium of geniuses that we could all stand on each other's shoulders and just make stuff better and better and better, because I could say, well, I don't think we can do it this way, but if you can optically enhance it, bam! Or if we can do a miniature for this with Mark Stetson. And that is why I truly believe all the stuff we did at Boss Films, all the greatest hits of the 80s, are so outstanding, because it was a huge kind of almost junior high school of effects geniuses that worked together.
That's cool. And it's kind of, well, at least for a while, it eventually became the model for, well, I mean, it is the model for Weta, for example, where you've got...
That's exactly right. That's a very good point. And this is why they do such good work, because they're all working on the same team instead of against each other, which unfortunately is what happens when you have a segregated group on a film where you've got your visual effects on one side, your makeup effects on one side, your pyrotechnics and model makers on another side. It creates friction. But we had no friction at Boss Film because we were all on the same side.
Is there any way, do you think, in the future to kind of bring everyone together, or a technique to do that? Because that seems the best way to do it.
Well, isn't Rodriguez kind of doing that with what he's doing in Austin?
He absolutely is. I mean, you mentioned Weta already, and they're doing it to great effect. I mean, look at Chappie.
Right. You know?
Yeah. Whether you like the movie or not, those robots are fucking amazing.
Yeah, that
I love Blomkamp.
Blomkamp is he understands how this stuff goes together, and everything again, whether you like the movies or not, everything looks fucking real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bottom line.
Yeah, that's all it is. It
looks like it's really there.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. That stuff in chat is unbelievable.
Since we're sort of bouncing around films, there's one film I found in your filmography that I really want to talk about. Do you remember 1991, Walter Sales, you did a movie called The Knife, a.k.a. Le Grand Art.
I do remember that.
Peter Coyote.
You dug deep, buddy.
Amanda Pays. I love this movie because it's about knife fighting. do you remember anything about it? I would imagine it was just superficial, like knife cuts and stuff. But
No. Here's the thing. I got a call from someone that couldn't go down to the movie. We shot the movie in Rio. Peter Coyote, who stars in it. We shot the movie in Rio de Janeiro, and I got a call. And some guy said, hey, listen, I got a call to do there's a serial killer that kills prostitutes, and once he kills them, he carves a P in their cheeks for prostitute, like the Scarlet Letter. He brands them as a prostitute once they're dead. And so he goes, you want to do the job? And I'm like, fuck, I've always wanted to go to Rio. Of course I'll do it. And I thought, it's just some half-ass bullshit, you know, third world country movie. I'll just go down there with a blood knife and get to see Rio and have a blast. Well, I didn't actually do that. I made a prosthetic that was kind of a little trick, and that would go on these girls' cheeks. And I made a blood knife, and I went down there, and it was a night shoot. And I'd go in, and these girls were naked. I'd go in the dressing room and have to put this, you know, at 3 a.m, this prosthetic on, and it would only work for one shot. And I'd go out on set, and we'd shoot it. And the director was he was the James Cameron of South America. He was never satisfied. And I was so not prepared for that. I just thought, this is just a cheesy little movie. I'll get a trip to South America, go to Rio, have some cachaça, go to you know, the Copacabana Beach. And night after night, I would go in. I was by myself. I'd have to apply this thing on naked girls. And the director was never, ever satisfied. And ultimately, we shot it like 4 or 5 times. I was down there for a week. And it was a really interesting experience. And then the director still wasn't satisfied. So he called me up. I went back to L.A. and he called me up. He goes, we got to do the shot better. And so I'm like, fuck, how can I possibly do it better? And so I came up with a way that we made a fake knife. We chrome plated it. And I inserted an X-Acto blade in the very tip of the knife, an actual razor blade. And then I made a very, very, very nano-thin fiberglass cheek protector, put a foam rubber piece over that, and we actually cut the foam on camera.
Oh, sweet.
Finally, the director was satisfied. But he literally ended up being the James Cameron of South America, and I was so not prepared for it. And I've never seen the movie, so it's good.
Oh, it's great. It's great. And it's got this real, honest philosophy to it. And it goes really deep into, like, fundamentals of knife fighting. Would you agree?
Yeah. Tom and I, we do a knife fighting and stick fighting class. So anytime some movie comes up like this, we're all over it.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. You know,
well, that's really interesting. I do remember that even though the guy hated my work on set, you know, we'd get off work and the whole crew would go out and get drunk until the sun came up. And there's like a whole different vibe to the South American film industry. And it was actually really, really fun. I enjoyed that. I'll never forget that experience. It was wonderful. That's one of the great things about working in the film industry. I think it's one of the reasons, actually, that I got into the film industry. I remember when I was like 15 years old. Reading articles on The Exorcist and seeing that Rick Baker went to Iraq with Dick Smith to do the Father Marin makeup. And I'm like, damn, I want to go to Iraq with Dick Smith. I want to travel the world. And guess what? The film industry has offered me this opportunity. And I've traveled all over the world. And it's one of the greatest things about the film industry because I love traveling. I've got a wanderlust and a real adventurous spirit, and it's just been the greatest thing to me about the film industry is to travel to all these places, meet all these really highly talented, creative people. It's just been a blast.
I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, this has got to be getting old telling these same stories.
Well, no, it is and it isn't, and let me just say this about that. You know, actors have to do it on press junkets. It's part of the job, so what are you going to do?
I have to ask him to do stories for Return of the Living Dead 3 that this guy began working on Monday for Lionsgate and Best
Buy. So, Heather, I think I know what you said. But yes. Say something now.
Hold on a second. I need everyone to know that we're back live and I'm recording.
Okay.
So, Heather, if you're going to say something spoilery, you should probably be aware of that.
Oh, I won't. I said I'm going to have to probably contact Steve, perhaps
Oh, you're doing spoilers. Business.
I don't know how.
Business.
Yes. Probably too spoilery.
Okay, are we ready?
Yeah, we're back.
Okay, let's do it.
And action.
Bam. Have you? When in the last episode we talked a little bit about this Rubber Rules. It's your YouTube channel. You were working with these guys and for one reason or another, it wasn't able to continue. Have you thought about figuring out a way to bring that back? Or,
well, I have, but here's the thing. I mean, again, it's like one leg on the dock, one leg on the boat. We're at a point now with technology that I feel that, you know, actual bookstores and actual books are a relic. They're sure. Not going to last a whole lot longer. And so a digital version of, let's just say, for instance, my book, would be amazing if, because the story can't really be told without the visuals and without, you know, so what we do is we make movie magic and it moves. That's why they're called movies. So to have a digital book where you could click on a photograph and then you get entered, like let's just say we click on a photograph of Don Rickles, you know, burning up as a vampire in innocent blood, and you click on that photo and you get all of our test footage, you get the clips from the movie, you get an interview with John Landis, you get an interview with me, with Don Rickles. Wouldn't that be amazing? Because you could just fall as far down the rabbit hole as you wanted, but that's a very difficult, very high, very rocky mountain to climb at this point. That would be the way to do it ultimately, I think, to make an interactive piece of entertainment where you could just tailor it for yourself and your own, you know, interests.
Yeah, the only franchise that comes to mind being able to support something like that would be something like Star Wars.
Well, I mean, we in one form, some of these big Blu-ray releases are like that. But again, you're talking about you got this physical thing you have to sit on your shelf.
Yeah.
But like for example, the Alien Saga Blu-rays, you know, they all have stuff like that. You click on,
and probably that great Thing disc that's coming out. I hear that's right. Also,
yeah,
gonna have a lot of great stuff on it.
Yeah.
So it does actually, kind of, you know, suck, because the whole time I'm writing this, I'm thinking, damn, we're missing so much because we're missing the visuals. You know, a picture doesn't really do a vampire deterioration justice. You know,
from a philosophical point of view, I mean, at the end of practical effects, people not having books anymore, people not having media in their house anymore, it's just that the human race is getting rid of anything that's a thing, but anything that's like a one and zero or a digital copy or something in a cloud seems to be more preferable. It's like almost shift. People want Blu-rays and they want VHSs. For me, I just want VHSs and everything else I own to be on a cloud. Everything.
Well, I think that's
what don't want any DVDs.
Well, it's totally going there, but the hoarder part of me wants the item. I want to see it.
And that's what I'm talking about, the horror fan, the collector.
Well, yeah, we do, but just wait. Just give it a generation that was not raised.
Right.
And sure. In this, we have to hold it. We have to put it on a bookshelf. Give it a generation, and it'll seem silly. I mean, remember when we had to buy DVDs? Remember when we had to go to the Blockbuster to run the VHS.
Well, you know, more to the point, look at it, what we're seeing now with film media is the same essential thing we saw a couple of years ago with the Kindle. With the introduction of the Kindle, everyone said print is dead, and it's turned out that in the wash, print is very much alive and Kindle is very much alive, and they're sort of cohabitating
right.
In that same
way. Well, they're cohabitating right now, but I think someday it's going to... I mean, like...
Yeah. Yeah, someday, exactly, and someday soon, within our lifetimes. I mean, you know, the fact is, we're considering as a stretch goal doing an audio version of this book.
Mm.
And, you know, me being...
I would love that.
That would be... You have a great voice for it.
Well, listen, I did a reading yesterday at Dark Delicacies, and people lost their minds. Stephen Norrington, the director of Blade and the Extraordinary Gentleman, came there, and he's read volume one of my book, and he's like, oh, my God, hearing you say it, I got the structure better, I got everything better. And everybody was like, oh, my God, you have to do... an audiobook. You have to. And here's the thing. I'm like, okay, so I talked to Sandy about it, Sandy Calora, who's doing all the the legwork on this, the, you know, running the Kickstarter and all the fulfillment and the graphic layout of the book. And when we talked about the audiobook, I'm like, so what do? Send him a CD? And he's like, are you stuck in the 80s? It's an MP3. Are you an idiot?
Yeah. You know what's interesting about audiobooks? Doug Stanhope has a new book out called Digging Up Mother, which I highly recommend. But what he did was, is for the print book is one thing, and for the audiobook, he went out and did corroborating interviews with the people that were involved in the story.
Yeah.
And added it to the book. So essentially, the book, the audiobook is an expanded version of what is in print.
Cool. Wow. You know what? That's a great idea, because I've had several people say something similar to me about that. Meaning, you know, when you get different viewpoints of the same story, mm-hmm. it actually adds a lot of weight to the actual story.
And it's nice for the listener, because it's a variety of voices that breaks up the monotony of someone reading a book to you.
Yeah. Are you saying I sound monotonous?
No, not at all.
I knew you were going to say that.
I know. But yeah, I think that's really interesting. And now with things that where you can bounce back and forth, like with this Amazon, I sound like a brand guy, but Amazon's Whisper Sync, where you're reading on Kindle.
What the fuck is Whisper Sync?
You're reading the book on Kindle, and then you go, oh, I got to go to the store, and you get in your car, and it syncs up to where you were last reading, God. And then goes up into the, and then reads it audio. And so you can, yeah.
This shit like that drives me crazy.
But it's the flexibility of the media, which is great.
Whatever. I want to sit down, read my damn.
I want a smelly book.
Set it down when I'm done.
I like all versions, because I have to sometimes drive 15 hours somewhere.
Yeah.
So I want to hear Steve's voice on that mission.
Well, let me tell you something. I already did a little bit of a timing on volume one, because we were seriously discussing doing a stretch goal of an audio version of this, of volume one. And, it's 6 hours.
Yeah.
Volume one alone is 6 hours. So add that. That's 30 hours if you go all through five volumes.
Well,
you could drive, Heather, you could drive from Los Angeles to New York four times and still not be done with Rocket.
When we did my audiobook,
Never done the cross country thing, but I need to, because I was thinking going to LA during Halloween.
Yeah, you need to come to
do. Yeah, freaking to do my cool makeup though.
Yeah,
and then I go to AFM after.
I know when we did my audiobook, it came out to 15 hours.
How many pages was it? How many words?
160,000.
160,000? That was only 15 hours, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a long book. That's only 15. Well, maybe mine's not 30 hours. But the way I did the math, I figured it would be between 5.5 and 6 hours just for volume one.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's tough.
But volume one is about 120,000 words.
What's really important, I don't need to say this, but I'm going to anyway, is I went through at least a dozen readers before I finally chose the best that was available.
Well, in Steve's case, he's lucky, because
he's going to read it himself. Never mind.
Yeah.
I withdraw the statement.
No, it's really funny. I wish someone would have... what I did at Dark Delicacies yesterday is I read the Michael Jackson chapter. And it was just so fun. And with the reaction to it, I kind of realized that, you know, who could possibly read it better than me? James Earl Jones, Morgan Freeman couldn't do a better job.
Well, it's true, because it's your story.
Exactly. So I know when to pause. I know when to go faster. I know when to slow down. I know when to be funny. I know when to be funny.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Anyone else doing it would be interpreting what they think you're trying. It's like, you know, it's like an actor trying to do what he thinks
or an
a director
author,
wants.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
An author reads. Yeah, yeah. Hey, sidebar, how great are Sue and Dell at Dark Delicacies?
They're amazing. They've backed me so much on this. I really love those guys. And they're the vanguard. I mean, they've got a fucking brick and mortar bookstore that specifically sells horror, fantasy, and genre stuff. And they love it, and they're doing a great job, and I wish them the best of luck.
Yeah, I first met them back in the mid-90s doing cons and stuff and getting them to carry the book and
just
stuff.
Just the fact that they've been around that long shows
how
their dedication.
And Dell's a hell of a writer, too.
What a good job they're doing.
Yeah, and he's doing a lot of editing and stuff and like compiling books like Ellen DeLisle's doing.
Cool.
Yeah.
This is interesting. We've been talking for like, a half hour, 40 minutes. We haven't even talked about any movies except for that one very obscure one.
Right, huh?
So, well,
is that okay?
Well,
no, it's great. I don't care. I don't know if your listeners care, but I don't care.
We kind of learned a long time ago that we, damn it, it's our podcast. We're going to talk about what we want. I do have a question. When you were developing the Scotch Light contact lenses,
right?
Was that the first time that? Well, first of all, that was for
Innocent Blood, John Landis vampire movie,
right? And was that the first time that had been done?
Oh, yeah, and the last time.
Yeah, was it? I mean, was it painful? Was it? Explain, please.
Well, the story behind that is kind of funny. I went in to meet John, and here's the thing. I'd done American Werewolf in London, and today's the 35th, I believe, the 35th anniversary of the that movie coming out.
Fuck!
Yes, I've seen all the pictures.
Happy birthday, American Werewolf in London.
Yay,
I still totally watch. I love that movie.
So in any case, yeah, no, I do too. So in any case, you know, I had met John on that film, and obviously, you know, Rick Baker and all of us and Landis did some pretty groundbreaking work on that film. And then I think the next film John did was actually, I don't know, I guess he did a few films in between, but the next effects film he did was Innocent Blood. And so instead of going to Rick Baker, he came to me. And I'm like, oh my God, what the fuck? I'm not talented enough to work on a John Landis movie. I'm not good enough. Why doesn't he hire Rick Baker? And it probably boiled down to the fact that I had a lot of enthusiasm on American Werewolf, and John had watched my work, and Rick was probably too expensive for Innocent Blood. So I went down to Universal and met him in his office, and I'd read the script, and we started talking about it. I said, hey, John, what do you figure these vampires' teeth should look like? And he said, they don't have teeth. And I'm like, they're going to gum their victims to death? What do you mean they don't have teeth?
I think I saw that movie back in the 80s in a back room of a VHS store. Go ahead, sorry.
That's a different
thing.
So I said, well, how do we know they're vampires? And he said, their eyes. And I said, what do you mean their eyes? He goes, well, we'll give them bright yellow eyes. And I'm like, John, really? How about red? You really, this has been overdone so much that nobody's going to get excited by that. And I go, this was right around the time that credit cards started laminating tiny little holograms to make sure that you weren't,
right.
What's the word? That you weren't, when you make fake money.
Counterfeiting.
Yeah, so you're not counterfeiting, right? So I actually got one, my first one. I'm like, oh my God, this is so fucking cool. There's a little hologram on my credit card. So I tore my credit card apart and I like dissected this little hologram and I thought, oh my God, there's got to be a way. If you can laminate a hologram on a credit card, then by God, you can laminate a hologram on a contact lens. Because back then we didn't have soft lenses. We had they were basically plastic shot glasses you had to shove in people's eyes. They were hard lenses. They were methyl methacrylate plastic cups that you had to, you know, you could paint.
Yeah, like funereal eye caps. Never
mind. I'm sorry, what?
like eye caps that mortuaries use.
Exactly. That's exactly what it's like.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, there's got to be a way to laminate these holograms on contact lenses on these hard plastic shells. And so I said to John, I said, look, okay, if the vampire's look is all based on their eyes, I'm telling you right now, I can't promise I can get this to work, but I think I can. Give me a couple of months, $50,000, and I will try to make holographic contact lenses. So I got with the best holographic engineers on the planet, and we got to work. And we made it work. We had, within about 2 months, we had holographic contact lenses that could project outside of the actor's eyes. Or, depending on how you design the hologram, you could see inside the skull. And they were unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, we're talking about fucking earth-shattering, groundbreaking shit here. Remember, there was no digital back then. Mm-hmm. You know, this was not like a rotoscoping thing. It was not a digital eye replacement. It was really happening right there. You could put these lenses in and go up to your friend, and you could project ballerinas out of your eyes. Are you kidding me? This was amazing. Here's the problem. What happened was I realized pretty quickly after the first few tests that the moisture from the actor's eyes ultimately within a couple of days destroyed the holographic effect. And so I didn't feel comfortable taking these on set because I thought, well, maybe they'll work for the first couple of days, but we're shooting for 4 months in Pittsburgh at night, and these things will stop working. And so I went back to John's office at Universal, and I said, John, listen, I tried my best. We got close, but it's not going to work. I don't feel comfortable. And he became volcanically enraged. He's like, what do you mean they're not going to work? You promised me holographic lenses. You're fucking me. You fucked my whole film up. How are people going to know these are vampires now? What, do you want me just to stick red contact lenses in them, yellow ones? And I'm like, John, you said in the beginning, you said we could just put yellow eyes in them. What are you talking about? This didn't work. I tried my best. I don't trust it. It's never going to work. And he's like, God damn it, Steve, get out. Get out of my office and go figure this shit out. And I'm like, I put my tail between my legs and I drove off the Universal lot. And at the intersection of Magnolia and Lancashire, I stopped at a stop sign, and it was nighttime. My headlights hit the stop sign, and stop signs are coated with a reflective 3M material called Scotchlight. And what it is it's gajillions of tiny glass beads that reflect back 1,000% of the light that hit them. That's why stop signs glow. And so instantly I thought, what if I put thousands of tiny glass shards in my actor's eyes?
What the brilliant. Fuck?
And that's what we ended up doing. And that's that. That was the genesis of those things. But it gets a lot more complicated than that. I mean, we took the blanks from the doctor. We did indeed coat them with Scotchlight. Then we sent them back to the doctor, and he coated them again to make them safe. But then that doesn't really work, because the way Scotchlight works is to truly get the 1,000% reflectivity, the light has to come directly from the eye. You can't be off center at all. So we had to use something called a beam splitter that was attached to the camera. So we built this custom beam splitter attached to the camera, worked with the director of photography, and made history.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but man, it's a startling effect still.
Yeah, and it all happened practically on set. And the really cool thing was you could actually, I came up, then I thought, I went crazy. I'm like, okay, if we can project light through a beam splitter onto these Scotchlight lenses, what happens if we change the color during the shot? So I came up with a color wheel that on the beam splitter, so that, like, if you remember Anne Perriod, she's fucking the guy, Anthony LaPaglia. Her eyes keep changing color as she's orgasming. Yeah. Orgasming, whatever the word is. That was all real. That happened on set because we had a color wheel attached to the beam splitter that projected on the Scotchlight. It gets a little bit scientific.
It's fucking cool is what it is.
How did Don Rickles like being a vampire?
That same thing.
Don Rickles, I just have to say, is my most favorite guy ever to have worked with in all of my hundreds of films. All of my movies, all of my rock videos, whatever, television episodes, animatronic theme parks. The guy is a living legend. He's a saint. He's so fun. I'll tell you a funny story. One of the reasons Don is so fun to work with is that he feels that it's his responsibility to not only entertain the audience when he's on camera, but to entertain the crew when he's off camera. And he's just the funniest guy ever. And so one night we're on Innocent Blood. It's like 4 a.m. Don's wearing a fourth stage vampire makeup. He's strapped to a hospital bed with fake tubes, fake monitors, fake everything. He can't move. He's drunk. He's cranky. He's 90 years old. And the ocularis went home because, you know, these are medical appliances. So we had a doctor to apply them into his eyes, into all the actors' eyes. But the ocularis is like, fuck this. I'm tired. I'm sleepy. I'm going home. So John's like, okay, let's do the glowing eye gag on Don. I'm like, John, the ocularis went home. He's like, we have to shoot this, Steve. You stick him at it. I'm like, fuck, he's 90 years old, he's drunk and he's cranky, you want me to stick shot glasses in his eye? And so my hands are shaking, I go up and I get the lenses and I'm like, man, it took like 5 minutes to get the first lens in. The whole crew is standing around. I'm working Don's eyelids like flapjacks on a griddle. They keep slipping in and out. I'm killing the guy. The crew is holding their breath, and finally I get one of them in. And Don turns to the crew and goes, I feel like a fag pirate. And it cut tension like a blade through a fruit. It was so fucking funny. I mean, Don is just hysterical. And it's all about timing. If anybody else would have said that, it wouldn't have been funny. But Don is just a genius at comedy. He's a true saint.
I just read Kevin Pollak's book, Sleeping My Way to the Middle. And he talks about being on the set of Casino.
Yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
Rickles just at every opportunity, just laying into De Niro.
Yeah.
And everyone on the crew was like, oh,
and Joe Pesci as well. I heard that Joe Pesci and Rickles had a really hard time together on that set.
When you're a little Steve Johnson, did you start your love of makeup and monsters by drawing them first, or were you always a sculptor?
I was always a sculptor. I've never developed the talent of drawing ever. I mean, I can do little silly doodles, and I used to do that, you know, more of a kind of Mad Magazine style.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I never really developed it because it never did much for me. I like working in three dimensions.
And when did you find that out?
The instant I started being interested in makeup effects. I mean, makeup effects are three dimensional, and I find it to be so much easier to see it from every angle and just get my hands in it and, you know, let my mind flow directly into the real world with clay or whatever. It's just much more. I don't have the patience to sit with a pencil or a pen and try to create dimension in, you know, three dimensions with two dimensions. Why not just go directly to the third? That's how I see it.
You realize that's unusual, right? I mean, like most people, you know, they got a pencil and a piece of paper when they're a kid and they start and then they figure out how to.
I always think it depends on the artist. I know a lot of like FX guys or just sculptors in general that's the best way that they can express their art is three dimensionally. And a lot of folks that draw and can't figure out the third dimension when they're trying to do a sculpture. So I think it just depends on the artist.
Well, I think that art is inherent. If you're an artist, you're an artist. So if you can sketch, you can sculpt. If you can sculpt, you can paint. If you can paint, you can sing. You know, it's a matter of what you put your attention on and what you develop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm going to guess you're not a big fan of things like ZBrush or ZBrush.
I love ZBrush.
Do you really? I do.
I'm not good at it because I'm techno-carded. I've played around with it. But the thing that I like about it is I'm not sure if it's good or bad for the art form because it becomes much easier, just like Photoshop or Liquify or anything like that. It becomes much easier to take more chances and to save them and to take a step back. So I think in some ways it makes people bolder, you know?
Mm-hmm. My only issue with it, and it's not an issue, I realize it's just another tool, another medium. But if I look at, we've talked about this before, if I look at John Dodd's sculpture, right, at John Dodd's makeup,
mm-hmm.
I know he did that. And if I look at a ZBrush sculpture, it could be anybody. I don't see the mark of the artist as much.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. But, you know, again, it's because, you know, you can mirror the sides. So you don't have to sculpt the whole thing. You can make it bigger or smaller. You can keep changing and keep going back. And so it does make it easier, and I'm not sure if that makes it better.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, Jordu did a video once, and this could have been on the Stan Winston school, and he said it's easier for him to make a maquette to sculptor. It's actually faster than most people do in ZBrush. So I think it's also technique as well, maybe. Because I don't know how long it takes to do something in ZBrush.
Jordu is an anomaly. You can't compare Jordu to any other artist. He's a machine. Of course it's easier for him. He can fucking sculpt while he sleeps.
I think he was sleeping during this demonstration. It's probably true.
Well, that's what's frustrating is that, you know, the best person skilled at a particular thing is not necessarily the best teacher
mm-hmm.
because they have something that everybody else doesn't have. It would be like, I don't know, some world-class gymnast is like, you know, sometimes they forget what it was like to start at the beginning, and they're like, you know, well, do a backflip. Mm-hmm. And you're like, how do I do a backflip? And they'd show you.
Mm-hmm. Right,
you
know, right, right,
here,
right,
you
right.
do it like this. And stuff.
Well, I always feel the last, sort of the last phase of being an expert in your work is able to teach it. Because with my work that I do, I realize it's like the idea of like searching for people, setting stuff up, that there's an art there. And I've never broke down my process to teach it to somebody else. And I think that's very important to do.
It forces you to be better when you
it does.
When you have
when you go like,
art. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
So Professor Johnson is yes. something I hope we see soon.
You hope what?
I hope to see Professor Johnson soon. Just
well,
like,
you know, it's interesting. You know what they say, that those who teach can't actually do it.
Yeah, but I think that's bullshit.
The older I get, the more I feel that there is a bit of a responsibility because, you know, the new people that are coming up. I mean, listen, people like me and, you know, when a lot of people came out to this reading yesterday at Dark Delicacies and a lot of my old pals from the industry, and I realized something. We've all got gray hair. We've all got beards. We no longer have, you know, distinguished abs. And I realized that we are the old timers now. And when I got into the business in the late 70s, you know, I'd look at these, you know, thick, gray-haired old codgers and go, those old-timers are bitter and they're assholes. And now we're those guys. And so
and now you're the bitter asshole.
That's true. And so now I think that there is a responsibility to support these new people coming up because they're the future of what we're all doing.
Yeah. What's great now is that...
And they all have the energy that we had 30 years ago, and God knows we don't have anymore.
Yeah, let them whip foam.
Yeah.
One thing that disturbs me, though, is that I run into a lot of thinking in some young people that's exclusionary. Like they say, I don't look at black and white films, or I don't do this kind of thing. We've bemoaned this on the podcast before, but with the advent of the internet now and the ability to this free exchange of information, where it used to be those were our secrets that we're going to keep them to ourselves, right? Because that's our market edge. But these days, everyone, I like the Stan Winston School and places like that, like what Scott Land's doing and like what some of the ADI is doing, is like this free exchange of information. And by default, I think it's not only educating, but also inspiring.
It is. And I think that the whole thing about, you know, the old 1950s way of holding secrets because you're terrified someone's going to steal from you is just so antiquated and so stupid. And it doesn't make sense. I think that only insecure people would ever do that because you can steal an idea. But guess what you can't steal? Mm-hmm. You can never steal the fountain from which that idea springs.
Right, I always say it's like it's one thing to chase the train, and it's another thing to drive it. You know, you're leading others, and the others are always going to be doomed to aping what you or other people.
Well, it comes from insecurity. If you're hiding or trying to, you know, hold close to your vest, your techniques, and then you're insecure because
I think you it's just make. I think on a subconscious level, you think it's a trick. Like, here's a trick I know that if I share it, it's no longer going to be my trick.
It's ultimately you thinking that you're not good enough. And so now you've got this one thing that you know works. And so you don't want, you know, you don't want somebody else to take it because, no, I get it.
That's what I love about Penn and Teller, how they just bust every magician.
Yeah. How great are those guys?
Yeah.
They're pretty amazing.
Yeah, I met Teller at a performance they did here in Bellingham.
Yeah,
and it was great. It was really, really great.
The thing that I'm really enjoying about, as you say, the sharing of information, is one the stuff that you just kind of never could get a handle on. You know, like trying to figure out, no, I don't know, cable controls or, you know, just something that, like, if you're not mechanically inclined or if you're just not that, you know, if you're a painter, sometimes it's hard for you to get a grasp of, like, the mechanics behind an animatronic. And so that's great, is that here's somebody that can actually, is like, here, it's like this. But what I really enjoy is seeing, and it's usually not something that's being taught. It's usually something that's happening in the background. You know, Rubber Rules was a good, really good example of this. You'd be showing a tape that you were doing for a director. It's like, hey, here's what it's going to look like. And if I'm paying attention to what people are doing in the background, and I'm like, oh, motherfucker, that's how, like, I was doing this so much harder, and this is so much easier. And it might be something as simple as moving a tentacle across a tabletop by putting a magnet under the table. You know what I mean? Just like dumb little shit like that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
And again, well, I think it's also a sense of community that moves the art forward. And I think if you play it too close to your chest, you lose the sense of community and you lose the sense of innovation and how everyone is innovating together.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing.
And then all of that.
You can't forget the fact that we all grew up, you know, loving this stuff. And we're all basically, whether we know each other or not, we're friends. We have the same tastes. We have the same excitement for the same things, and so why would you be enemies?
Right.
And this free exchange of information is so inspiring. You know, like,
oh, it is. Yeah,
and
yeah,
like,
yeah.
For example, last.
Well, it's not like we're building missiles to fire at China, for fuck's sake.
You know, like, it's like last night, I stumbled upon a 3-hour interview with Johnny Depp, and he was talking about living with Thompson and,
sure.
and just sort of the creative process and how he looks at choosing roles and that kind of thing. And there was plenty there that I could pull from and be inspired by. But there, it's something I never would have seen back in the day. Never would have even lucked upon back in the day.
Right.
But now with this depository of places like YouTube and the Winston School and the Rubber Rules thing.
Yeah, let's talk about the Winston School. That thing is so cool. And, you know, while, you know, maybe directors and producers aren't paying a lot of money to have people like me build things and aim cameras at them.
Sure.
The art form has exploded.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Monsterpalooza. Look at all these conventions every week somewhere around the world. Look at these kids in Romania that are doing work that would make Dick Smith roll over in his grave. And it's all because of things like the Stan Winston School, where this free exchange of information along with visuals, you know, is being shared. And it's only serving the purpose of elevating the art form. And let me tell you something, never mind the renaissance of new materials like silicone, it's the information that's out there now. When I was a kid, there was no information. I was figuring the shit out myself. If I found a dried apple in the backyard and its skin was all pruny, I'd cut it off with my mom's kitchen knife and take some Elmer's glue and glue it on my pal's face and go, there's a zombie. And that was all I could do. Yeah. But now you can go on the Stan Winston School and bam, you know, well, it's only serving to elevate the art, which is brilliant because people are doing this just for fun, just to express themselves now. And they're doing it more, I think, now, these days, than ever before. And there's more work happening in people's garages and basements than there ever has been put on film before. It's astounding. And that in itself is elevating the art.
If you would have told me back in the day that there was going to be a regular TV show that focused on effects like Face Off, you'd think that was crazy.
Yeah.
But right. Here we are. Not only is it on the air, but it's successful.
It's a huge hit.
Yeah.
I love to watch it. I'm curious, just in that line of thinking, is that if people who are doing what we consider practical effects nowadays, we call it that, all this is existing sort of like off camera, off screen, not in films. What does it become as an art form?
Well, I'm sorry, what was the question?
It's a little esoteric because it's if all these beautiful makeups and all these beautiful sculptures don't exist to be creatures in films, they sort of exist on their own. What does that speak of, like, the future legacy of special effects as its own art form or becoming fine art? At some point.
I think you're right. I think you said that. It is fine art because, you know, did Michelangelo have people film his stuff?
Nope.
Exactly. There you
and
go.
I think that's where it's going. I mean, there are other venues that are popping up that we've, you know, that have become created, cosplay, things like that. But I think that now, and it probably already is, we're going to see installations in museums. And
oh, it's already happening. Look at Patricia, what's her name? You know what I'm talking about?
No. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's this entire new movement now of hyper-realistic art, and there are several artists that are doing it, and it's all based on makeup effects techniques. They're doing silicone, hair-punched stuff, yeah. And I can't remember her last name, but yeah, there's a fucking entire group of people that are doing hyper-realistic art. And it's going in museums, and it's selling, like, you know.
It's like the guy did the giant baby. Have you seen the giant baby?
Yeah.
Yes, I have, yeah.
Super realistic.
Yeah, like that. Essentially, that's what Mike Hill does.
Yeah.
And Ubler and all these guys. It's like they're making these.
No, it has truly become an art form. Look what Chet Czar does with his conjoined shows. I mean, it truly is an art form now. And it wasn't 30 years ago.
Yeah,
Chet's the bomb.
Yeah,
I love that guy's stuff.
Cool. Yeah,
he's very cool. But I feel when I look at his work, that almost falls into sort of the pop surrealism movement a bit, like where Mark Ryden is.
Yeah,
yeah,
maybe.
Right. For the idea of like of folk, but I mean folks standing around in makeup to observe it, to look have showings around that. What is, because I never thought of
history.
It.
Mm-hmm. You know what they always say? You can never be a king in your own kingdom. Chet's going to go down in history, and unfortunately, artists only get their respect after they're dead. But Chet is just cranking shit out. And when I look at one of Chet's paintings, I fall into it, and I live in that world. And that's the sign of a true artist to me. It's like Bikshinsky. It's like Giger. I mean, he's that good to me.
Yeah. Have you?
And he's a makeup effects guy. So this speaks to exactly what we were just saying. Makeup effects have become art.
Have you seen the stuff that Joshua Hoffine does?
I haven't. Don't know the
name. Hoffine, what he does is he sets up photographs that are sort of otherworldly, for want of a better word, that employ on set, like, practical effects that...
It's basically making a trick photograph without not using the process, but using what's on
set. Right, he builds sets. It's just like a film, but he's doing...
He's just doing a still.
He has a movie out called Black... I have it somewhere. Black Lullaby.
Black Lullaby.
And he himself has a Kickstarter going.
Everybody's got a Kickstarter. But right now, the only Kickstarter that's important is this one.
This one, yes. Rubber.
That's right. Let's pimp me out, kids.
Yeah,
come on.
We're doing that now, sir. When does the campaign wind up?
You said I think we've got 11 days left.
Right on.
Okay. And
we're so funded, it's pathetic right now. I mean, we're like $12,000 away from the fund. And I mean, again, I have to say, I think I mentioned this earlier, but the thing that's unique about this campaign, or not unique, but unique to me, is that we're really just pre-selling the book. And it's going to be a lot more difficult to get the book after the campaign. It'll still be available in certain venues, but this is the time to order it. And this is the only time you can get the little Slimer figure or a T-shirt. And those are the only things we're offering. I mean, we're not saying, you know, throw $10,000 and we'll give you, you know, hats off in the acknowledgement. It's just buy the fucking book, kids.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And
which I think is really honest. I like that approach.
It's really honest, and truthfully, this is... The book is the, I mean, like, it really, I want a sticker. No, I want the fucking book. That's the important thing. I want the information. I want the visuals.
Are there any plans once all five are completed to do either like slipcases, sets of it, compilation, you know?
Is it too early to talk about that?
No, it's not too early, because here's the thing. I mean, you never know what the future holds, but I do know this. This is going to open a lot of avenues for me, and I've already had, get this, guys, get this. We'll talk for another 45 minutes on this one. I've already had a Netflix producer contact me saying, this would make a great series.
Fuck. Of course.
Yes.
Would make a great
hair, you've got the music, you've got the passion, you've got the 80s, you've got the...
How's the time?
Now is the time, because there's such a nostalgia for that type of film.
Could you imagine vinyl in the effect?
And you've got the drugs. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Oh, so dude.
Are you familiar with what I'm saying?
Talk about David Duchovny thing. It's like fucking Californication with monsters.
Yeah. Are you familiar with vinyl on HBO?
No.
Yeah. It's already come and gone.
It's come and gone. It was a series about record producers in the 80s. To have that done in an effect shop, come on.
Right now.
I know. I mean, it's a fucking no-brainer. You get the right producers behind this, and you base it generally on my five-volume series,
mm-hmm.
fucking knock it out of the park.
Okay, this is going
to... Unfortunately, I can't play myself. We'll have to hire Robert Downey Jr.
Right, exactly.
Hey.
Yes.
Downey Jr. just signed on with the True Detective guy. They're bringing Perry Mason back.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, you know what, Perry Mason, believe it or not, on like TV Land, it's a solid rating. It's to this day, it's a solid rating.
Yeah,
together.
Raymond
Burr, man.
Yeah.
Fucking
Ironside. All right, we're boring your listeners now. We didn't talk about the movies. We didn't talk about anything.
You know,
over an hour, and I told you after that fuck up last Sunday, I'd give you 30 minutes. What are we doing here?
I know, right? I kind of like it. We're not talking about the movies.
Well, I wanted to know how it was to work on a Cronenberg set for Videodrome.
Oh, will you shut up? Didn't we cover this last time in the Lost episode?
But it's lost forever.
Yeah.
That's right, no, and it will remain lost forever.
It lives in our memory.
Heather just wants to hear about David Cronenberg.
She just wants to hear you talk about, you know, how tight is David Cronenberg's ass. It's like, it's basically is what she's looking for.
Well, let me just say this. David Cronenberg is a genius, and if I live to be another 10 years old, I hope I look as good as him. That guy's a good-looking guy. He is.
He does look great.
Yeah.
It's amazing. How'd that happen?
I know. That's good living, maybe.
Canadian.
No, it's not good living. It's not good living. I know the guy.
Yeah.
He's like, there's a chance.
I seem to remember, maybe I dreamed this, but I seem to remember doing a lot of cocaine with Debbie Harry and James Woodson and David on a set of video games. Maybe I dreamed it. Maybe I dreamed it. I'm not sure. Don't hold on that.
I would love to be in a room with a coked out James Woods.
That's not hard to think about, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does that not go sideways? That's awesome.
Let me tell you a quick story, and then we'll wrap this up.
Okay.
When we were doing Videodrome at Rick Baker's studio, Dick Smith was living in Larchmont at the time in New York, the suburb of New York, and he needed someone to help him do a nude life casting of Debbie Harry. And so Dick called up Rick, and he said, well, Jesus, Rick, I just don't have enough hands to cover her entire body in alginate. Could you send me out one of your assistants? And so I'd never been to New York, and Rick sent me out on a red eye to meet Dick Smith at Grand Central Station. And I took the train to Larchmont, and I met Dick. And Dick made a lovely quiche for lunch, and Debbie Harry showed up. She knocked on the door, and she had no idea what she was in for. And so we go down to Dick Smith's basement, and Dick asked her to disrobe, because in Cronenberg's original script, remember James Woods' vagina chest where he loses his gun?
Yeah.
Well, Debbie had one of those too in the original script. And so this is why we had to take this nude torso cast of Debbie. And so Debbie has no idea what's going on. And this is the height of her career, the absolute height of her career. She had no, and I was a huge fan. So she had no idea, and of course a Dick Smith fan. She had no idea what was going on. So she's in this tiny suburb of Larchmont. She goes down to this basement with a 19-year-old me and a Dick Smith, and we ask her to take her clothes off. It was so weird. And the funniest part, I could go on forever about this, but she takes her top off and she's looking around at, you know, there's Linda Blair as the Exorcist, there's little, you know, Dustin Hoffman as little big man. And Dick leans in really close to one of her nipples, and there's a hair growing out. And he's like, oh, Debbie, this just won't do. This might stick in the casting. May I pluck it out? And she's like, whatever turns you on, dude. Dick took a tweezer and plucked this hair out of her nipple, and that's the story.
Yeah. Good enough, right? That's good work if you can get it, right?
And cut.
Yeah. Well, I want to, again, push everyone to go to Kickstarter and give Steve your ducats.
All your money.
Yeah, because this
all
is, this I think, and I'm not, no, not to blow any smoke, but the idea, like, this is such an important era in our sort of, as you say, our shared history, and this is a documentation of that. This is really kind of putting you in the room.
Yeah.
So
it is. It's written in present tense. It's written with dialogue. It's not like it all started on a snowy day in February when I was born in Houston, Texas. It's not that at all. And then going through ad nauseum my childhood, it leaps back and forth between the biggest directors, the biggest actors, the most insane stories. It's a wild fucking ride, and nothing like this exists. Nothing like it will ever exist again.
Right on. So go give them your money, kids. Steve, thanks for coming by, man.
Yeah, that was fun. Hopefully you pushed the record button this time.
Stop. So that's awesome. Steve, what a guy.
Yeah.
Motherfucking Johnson. Yeah.
That's right. Right? Steve motherfucking Johnson. Damn, we didn't do that this time.
Yeah.
All right, we'll do it
now. We've done it right now as a fan.
Yeah. I just love any opportunity to talk to people that, you know, can be, A, put us in that the room at one of those times,
mm-hmm.
but also it gives you an idea of like that perspective, that place where creativity comes from.
And right.
I think that's the real boon.
That's the thing about Steve Johnson is that You know, everybody talks about how candid he is and how he's not afraid to share, you know, the ugly stories as well as the good stories. But what folks who are focusing on that forget about is how innovative Steve Johnson is.
Well, I didn't even know the story about the lenses.
Oh yeah.
And now that
I only remember in Fangoria them talking about the lasers into the eyes.
I remember right. that.
Not how that was created. That was awesome. A brilliant story. But really? For me, like all the FX guys, as someone who was like first and foremost a horror fan, to me it's like there was no one more special or wonderful, and I think a lot of Fangorians, a lot of horror kids felt that way in the 80s and 90s than the FX guys. Because we were there to see our directors, we were there to sometimes see the actors, but really, we were there to see the monsters and effects. Uh-oh. And I will always, until the day that I drop dead, be there for the rubber monsters and the effects.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
It's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle choice.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I run into it. It's changed for me personally, but I still run into it in some fans where, you know, do I watch this film that's a drama that I know is good? Or do I watch this one-star horror film on Netflix and they go for
a horror film? Yeah, I'm surrounded by all this VHS and DVDs and Blu-ray players. And they go like, what do you want to watch? It's like, I want to watch Mausoleum and Rocktober Blood. Yeah. That's what I want.
Yeah. Care. And I think it's different because there's also the fan out there now that news that's a week old, they do not give a fuck about it.
Right, exactly.
You know, and it's so...
Yeah. That's a different lifestyle. Yeah. It's a different life choice. Fine.
We're wrapping up this episode 89. Is there anything, Heather, what are you working on? Do you want to talk about anything?
I just finished all the shooting for Waxworks 1 and 2 for Lionsgate and the Vestron discs.
Uh-huh. Right on.
And the next one that we're working on, which is, it was announced, should be... Return of the Living Dead Part 3.
Oh, yeah, that'll be cool.
Because there was that first section. It was Blood Diner, and then Chopping Mall, and then Waxworks 1 and 2 as a disc, and then Return of the Living Dead 3, and then allegedly in the pipeline, there's going to be more and more Vestron releases coming.
That's out. See, somebody got smart.
Yeah.
You know. Which I know about, but...
And right on. And what are you doing really the rest exciting. Of the day? What are you doing the rest of the day?
I'm on Long Island over my friend Kevin's house, who's a horror host. And so I was going to go walk around the corner to Polish Town to the Polish Fest and drink very dark beers.
Sweet.
Yes.
Wait, what about you?
For me right now, it's all about Bleeding Hand. Trying to get everything ready and running parallel to that. We're actually working on a film because we don't like that we can't make a film because we're in charge of Bleeding Hand.
Right, guys should.
So we're making a film.
Right on. Have you sidebar? Have you seen Kubo yet?
No.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm reading nothing but awesome stuff.
I know. It's. I'm so. I can't wait.
Me, buy my book. I'm writing the next one. It's called String of Pearls. I'm working on something now that I'm pretty excited about that I can't talk about, but it's awesome. The 360.
Are you gonna release it? Are you gonna release any books on tape for me for my journeys?
I don't know. You know, we did. We put up as a midweek podcast a sort of dramatic reading of one of my things. You look back an episode or two, you can find it. I liked it. I liked the response, and we may do something more of that. You know, we'll see. Right now, it's all about making the companion piece to Moonlight Serenades, which is available on Amazon. Please buy it. And then there's the 366 on my site where I'm reviewing a movie a day that is a lot of this deep catalog stuff.
Sure.
That is cool. All right. So go to our Facebook page. Please talk to us. Let us know what you think of the show and what you want to see.
All right.
All right. So for episode 89 in the Bonus Material Podcast, I'm Tom Carnell.
I'm Heather Buckley.
And I'm Langley West. Stay scary.